This is the takeaway for Monday, February 12th, 2018.
This is the takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, filling in this week. Thanks for listening. This weekend, President Trump seemingly cast doubt over the Me Too movement. In a tweet, he said, quote, "People's lives are being shattered and destroyed by a mere allegation. Some are true and some are false. Some are old and some are new. There is no recovery for someone falsely accused. Life and career are gone. Is there no such thing any longer as due process?" The president's tweet comes after White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter resigned over allegations of domestic abuse by his ex-wives. The president's reaction on Friday?
It was very sad when we heard about it, and certainly he's also very sad. Now, he also, as you probably know, he says he's innocent, and I think you have to remember that. He said very strongly yesterday that he's innocent. So you'll have to talk to him about that, but we absolutely wish him well.
It's not the first time the president has defended men accused of sexual abuse or harassment. He's also supported Roy Moore, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, Corey Lewandowski, and Steve Bannon, all after allegations of sexual assault surfaced.
He totally denies it. He says it didn't happen. And, you know, you have to listen to him also.
President Trump said, "I think he's a person I know well. He is a good person."
They're saying these horrible things about him. It's very sad because he's a very good person.
And at least 19 women have accused the president of harassment or abuse, including his first wife, Ivana, who said in a sworn deposition that he forced himself on her. For our next guest, the latest sexual abuse scandal to come out of the White House hits very close to home. Karen St. James says she can relate to Rob Porter's ex-wives, both of whom alleged abuse, and one who had a photo of herself with a black eye. Karen is not her real name, but she used it to chronicle her story of verbal and emotional abuse, which she says is not only invisible to others, but also debilitating.
Well, the blog that I read was the one that said why I stayed. And I think when you're in an abusive type situation, first of all, you can't. It took a long time for me to accept that that's what it was. And you justify reasons as to why he's acting a certain way, and you try to accommodate.
Karen said she read a blog post written by Rob Porter's ex-wife, Jenny Willoughby, where Willoughby detailed a marriage full of verbal and emotional abuse. And she understood.
It is extremely hard to accept that you are being abused. You don't, you know. I think I wrote in my blog, you know, we're educated people and we lived in a high class neighborhood and this doesn't happen. You know, I was behind all those scenarios of believing abuse is just, you know, low income people and abuse is just physical. So I refuse to believe that that's what it was.
And in your case, when the abuse, which wasn't physical, it was verbal abuse, started, did you immediately understand what was happening, or it took you quite a while to sort of understand it or admit that this was actually happening?
No, it took me a long time to understand what was going on. He, at the time when it started to escalate, there was a health issue with him, basically. And so I just thought he was upset about that and he was trying to get well and he was trying to get me to help him. And once he got better, everything would be fine. But that didn't happen. And I kept trying to find out ways to help him. And I kept looking on the internet, like, you know, my husband's so angry, what should I do about it? And verbal abuse kept coming up and I kept like just skipping past it because I was like, you know, he's wonderful sometimes, you know, he can be very loving and charming and everything. So I just kind of ignored it until I think the one time I finally opened it, like, oh, I'm going to open this because this isn't true. And I just want to get this off my radar, basically. And when I read it, I was dumbfounded because I was like, everything was hitting the mark and telling me that I was being abused.
Karen, I also want to bring Julie Goldscheid into this. Julie is a CUNY law school professor who works on issues of gender violence. Julie, how difficult can it be to recognize when you're in an abusive relationship?
So even sometimes when it's physical, it can be hard to recognize and hard to identify because there are so many biases and so many societal forces and psychological forces that lead us to want to think everything's okay, everything's going to be okay. Relationships are very complicated. Abusive relationships are particularly complicated. And people often have a mix of feelings that can make it hard to figure out what course to take.
And I'm wondering, based on what Karen is saying, there's also this sort of idea that it could never happen to me, right? We're educated and we live in a good home and we're a happy couple. And that sort of doesn't always apply.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we know that abuse affects people of all classes, of all races. And like I said, there are a lot of biases that play into how people experience it. It's true also that there are factors such as poverty that can make abuse more prevalent, that can exacerbate how hard it is to cope with it.
Karen, I want to come back to you. When you tried to tell friends about what was happening to you, did they believe you or were they skeptical because they didn't see any physical wounds or visible wounds?
I really haven't. I mean, I'm still, even though I have left the situation, I really haven't opened up to many people about it because I was too afraid, especially when I was in it. People always saw the facade that he was portraying, that he was this, you know, successful business person. You know, we'd go out to dinner, he would always pay and, you know, tip generously and give extravagant gifts and things like that. So people never saw it. Since I have left, I really just say, well, things just weren't good. He was very controlling. He became obsessed with money. I did finally confess to one group of friends, and the husband in it is still having a hard time with it. And his words were, well, it's hard for me because I haven't seen it with my own eyes, which just crushed me. It's hard because I think you feel with abuse, the onus is on you to prove that you're being abused verbally and emotionally and psychologically and all that stuff. And it's really hard to describe what it's like when you're in it.
And you reference, Karen, the hashtag Maybe He Doesn't Hit You, which was created by Zaira Kelly, who tweets under the handle Bad Dominicana. What was it about that hashtag that sort of resonated with you in your situation?
It showed all the different ways that they abuse you, I guess. Simple terms as that is that they slowly isolate you from your family. They slowly isolate you from your friends. When the front door closes, you know, they're a monster. But just reading all the accounts of women of saying, like, you know.
You just felt connected to other women sharing similar stories.
And that's so common. Many researchers and experts talk about domestic violence and intimate partner violence in terms of coercion and control. And it's that pattern of coercion and control and economic control and jealousy and threats that really describes the nature of the problem. I don't want to say even more than physical abuse, but when you compound that with physical abuse, and it often leads to physical abuse, it's really, really harmful. So we tend to think about intimate partner violence just in terms of the physical abuse, but it's really much more than that.
And also, it's something that there's this term that gets batted around, due process. The president just used that term in his tweet. We hear a lot about due process, but let's really explain what this is. Yeah. What exactly does due process mean?
So you're absolutely right that due process gets thrown around in a lot of contexts. So due process as a legal matter means the constitutional promise that the state won't deprive someone of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And what that really refers to is basic notions of fairness. The idea that you should get notice of complaints against you and the opportunity to make your case before you're subjected to punishment or have some property right taken away or have some other important interest taken away. So as a legal term, it really refers to something that can be taken away by the state. So we think of it most commonly in the criminal context where, of course, liberty is at stake. And it's really important to respect due process. And we have various procedural protections put in place, particularly in the criminal justice system, because liberty interests are so important. But due process comes into play in other contexts as well.
I'm wondering if – because the way you're describing it sounds like it's sort of being conflated with slander or libel, right, at this point, where if there's someone who's accused and it's a very public accusation and this is a well-known person, that suddenly people are calling for due process, but I think what they really mean is let's handle this behind the scenes until it's been confirmed. Is that
It's two different things. I mean, the idea of due process is really important. We know that allegations of wrongdoing can be very harmful to the person on the receiving end. But we also know, as we've been talking about, how hard it is to come forward with allegations of abuse, how often abuse takes place in private, how much societal biases have tilted toward not believing the person making the accusations, leaving many people say that they feel doubly victimized when they come forward. So we have to balance two really important competing interests, which are really hard. So the idea of slander or libel, you know, the defamation, that comes into play when someone makes an allegation in response that they've been unfairly characterized. And we know there are plenty of lawsuits where people contend those two issues. But I think what's most important to recognize is that the promise of due process is foundational to our democracy, really. And it means that before a decision is made, whether it's about liberty interests or whether it's about someone's job, that the person making the decision gets the benefit of hearing both sides of the story. And with cases of abuse, it's really important that that decision maker has an understanding of the history and context of domestic intimate partner violence so that they can make a fair judgment about who's telling the truth. We often hear about these cases in terms of one person's word against the other, and that's just the way it is. So a decision maker should be fully informed about what we know about the nature of abuse and how it plays out.
Karen, did you ever feel that way? Did you ever feel like if you decided to go to an attorney or to seek, you know, some other sort of help for this, that you would be, that you wouldn't be believed?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's hard to describe how he made me feel because he would just talk and talk and talk until I would understand where he was coming from. And I could see it, you know. They have a way of spinning things and readjusting the way you're thinking to make you really believe what they're saying. When I finally decided to attempt to leave, I had done enough research to know that, I guess basically what's happening here with President Trump saying, you know, you need due process, that when somebody's abusing you, those abuse allegations aren't taken seriously.
Julia, so, have you seen that as well?
Oh, absolutely. And it's been well documented. I mean, another part of the tweet suggested that a single allegation could, you know, cause devastating harm to someone. And certainly in the legal context, I've rarely, if ever, seen that. To the contrary, there are many cases where there are a lot of allegations of abuse, and it could be really hard to be believed.
Thank you, Julie. And Karen, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and hopefully inspiring other women to listen to their gut.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've all been watching the Olympics, a beautiful display of world unity and peace in the name of sports, a moment for countries to come together to cheer on their top athletes. But Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, says there's always a darker side to the Olympic Games.
I've been covering the Olympics since roughly 2004, the Athens Olympics, which were also the first post-9/11 Olympics. And what I see in each and every place is the same pattern, and that's debt, displacement, and the militarization of public space. Now, these are facets that certainly existed before 9/11, but since 9/11, you've seen it ratcheted up to a shocking extent, to the degree to which the host cities themselves become completely disfigured by the Olympics, and it becomes an aggravator for problems that already exist, because in many cities, those are already issues. You know, displacement, another word for that is gentrification, you know, militarization, hyper-policing, debt, of course. I mean, these are issues we speak about in the best of times in the big cities in this world. And yet the Olympics tend to make all those problems much worse.
And you see in a recent op-ed, you describe this as the chasm between the glitzy spectacle and the grittier reality of the Olympics. You say that that's become a feature of the Games.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the tale of two Olympics. Every Olympics is really two Olympics. I mean, you have the Olympics that, of course, are incredibly pleasurable for the viewer because it's a time for us to engage with sports that otherwise we don't usually get to see. You know, and that can be a beautiful thing, to see that kind of physical expertise and the awesome power of some of these different events. I know in my house we were watching figure skating last night, you know, just at the very start of it. The Olympics also also make a tremendous amount of money for sponsors and a tremendous amount of money for the weapons industry. And by weapons, in this case, we're talking about closed-circuit TV cameras, drones, hyper-surveillance, tear gas, things of that nature, the latest in tear gas, which is always developing new technology. So you've got that aspect of it, but then you've got the people who actually have to live in these cities. And for them, they're going to be paying for the Olympics for years, if not decades, after they're done. There's no such thing as a cost-neutral Olympics. These Olympics, for example, in Pyeongchang, they're already in at over double what they thought it would be. It was a $6 billion budget. It's costing $13 billion. Now, that money has to get paid somehow, and it's not being paid by sponsors, and it's not being paid by ticket sales, which are anemic at this point, which even with the games already really underway. So this is where we are, and it's very painful. John Carlos, who was an Olympian back in 1968, he, of course, famously raised his fist on the medal stand with Tommy Smith. He has this line that I always repeat where he says, the reason they only have the Olympics every 4 years is because it takes them 4 years to count the money.
Wow. But Dave, I mean, there's a lot of bad news out there these days. And I think,
sure,
you know, aren't we being a little bit of a downer here by sort,
yes,
of, you know, piling on in the Olympics? And is the one thing, you said you were watching figure skating last night, so was I.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a break. Let's talk a little bit, though, about North Korea and South Korea. Isn't this a good thing, at least?
Man, it's so interesting. It's like, yeah, let's talk about a break. And oh, by the way, the nuclear hotspot on Earth is where the Olympics are going to take place. What's happening between North and South Korea is fascinating because on the one hand, we saw in the opening ceremonies, North and South march out together. And there's the way in which these Olympics are being played up as if it is signaling a thaw in relations between North and South. And it's certainly true that South Korea is, because of the belligerence of Donald Trump and his inability to practice diplomacy or have a State Department, that South Korea is trying to use these Olympics to basically go around Washington, D.C. and try to negotiate with North Korea to lessen tensions. That being said, they need to worry about lessening tensions in their own country because there is popular resistance in South Korea to this kind of joint marching exercise for the openings of the Olympics. Polls show 70% of the country is against the women's hockey team, North and South, coming together and performing as one, because you can't wipe away those tensions that do exist between North and South. And what should frighten South Korean leaders is that a lot of these numbers aren't coming from people who are elderly, people who remember the Korean War or grew up with stories. It tends to be younger South Koreans who don't like growing up under the specter of nuclear annihilation.
What about those of us like you and I who are sitting in our living rooms and will probably be sitting in our living rooms or on looking at our phones and watching these games? Are we allowed to watch them and enjoy them?
Of course. I mean, I don't think there's any such thing as a sport that's somehow clean and somehow pure. And so I just think it's about us being conscious as we watch these events, like what is happening behind the scenes, who's paying a price for it. But you can make those arguments about most sporting events. I mean, the Olympics is pretty egregious. And I think there are very real reforms that we should be conscious of. And if the Olympics are coming to our town, I think we should be prepared to organize and fight against it. So a lot of this is about us just being very knowledgeable about the price tag, both in terms of actual money and in terms of the human and social cost of what goes into hosting the Olympics. Because if there's one thing I've seen in covering this over the last, 15 years or so, is that the only thing that forces the International Olympic Committee to change is when people in prospective host cities say, we are not going to host. That's the only thing that gives them pause. And we've seen that in Oslo, Krakow, Chicago, Boston. I mean, you've seen popular movements to not host the Olympics.
Maybe we'll see some of that in the next Olympics.
I think that's highly possible, particularly, though, if you look at Los Angeles, which is supposed to host the Summer Games in 2028. I mean, that's 10 years away. And I can tell you that people are already organizing in Los Angeles to make sure that as the Olympics are built over the next decade, it's not done on the backs of Los Angeles's poor.
Something to absolutely stay aware of and conscious of. Thanks so much, Dave, for joining us.
No, thank you.
Dave Zirin is a sports contributor for The Takeaway and sports editor for The Nation magazine. You can catch him on the Edge of Sports podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, filling in this week. Every 10 years since 1790, the United States has taken a census. But as we look ahead to the 2020 census, there's a growing concern that our government isn't prepared for the Herculean challenge of counting every person in the country. And that's why the U.S. Conference of Mayors raised alarms about the census last week. Diane Schanzenbach is director of the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University.
A successful and accurate decennial census is crucial to the United States for a number of reasons. Having an accurate representation of the number of people that live, you know, in every state allows us to know how many congressional representatives each state should get. It also affects the distribution of billions of dollars of federal funding, infrastructures, hospitals, schools, job training programs, etc.
Now, there is this letter by the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and they are very concerned about this upcoming 2020 census. What are the concerns?
So what they're concerned about are three things. First, funding, leadership, and then also this proposed citizenship question. Let's talk about funding. Increasingly, the census has been harder and harder to conduct. So after the last census, the Census Bureau sat down and said, okay, we know we need to keep costs under control. And so we're going to do some innovative things here. We're going to use better technology, better leverage existing data sources. We're going to test certain messaging to see if we can get people to comply a little more cheaply. So we calculated that relative to this plan that the census had that would, in the end, give us a very accurate census but save some $5.3 billion overall, you know, they needed to have extra funding along the way to make these preparations. So Congress has been underfunding. We calculated by about $230 million over the last several years. And so it hasn't been ramping up. They haven't been able to make these investments. So we're very concerned. You know, if they're not able to do these innovative new things, then, you know, either we're not going to save that money, we're going to spend a lot more money, or we're not going to get the accuracy that we've historically had and that we need in the census.
That was Diane Schanzenbach, director of the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. We're talking about the U.S. Census, and I want to bring in Anne Morning into the conversation. Anne is an associate professor of sociology at NYU and a member of the Census Bureau's National Advisory Committee on Racial, Ethnic, and Other Populations. Anne, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the racial and ethnic data that's currently collected. Why does the government need to know that?
The government is collecting these data in order to be able to implement policies and particularly to enforce our nation's anti-discrimination laws. So the racial and ethnic statistics that we collect allow the government, for example, to enforce the Voting Rights Act. It provides the data on race as well as age and sex that we need for redistricting boundaries and for protecting the rights of minorities to vote. And we also use these racial and ethnic data as a benchmark to monitor or to look for evidence of discrimination. So it's the census data which let us know, for example, if in a particular industry, people of a particular race, let's say, are not being hired at the rates we should. The census gives us the data to be able to benchmark or check these kinds of practices.
And also, let's talk a little bit about how politics influences the census, because you've said that it can be used to silence, undercount, or even oppress certain communities.
Well, let's look at it this way. The Census Bureau is basically a tool of government. It provides the information that the government needs to enforce its laws, to implement its policies. And so if those policies are in some way oppressive, then certainly census data can be used towards those negative ends. We certainly have evidence of that in our nation's history. If we go back to the very first census in 1790, at that time, the Constitution ruled that slaves should be counted as only three-fifths of a person. And so the Census Bureau made it possible to count people in those kinds of ways by classifying people as slave, as white, or as other free people.
So, Anne, I wanted to dig a little deeper into the race questions here as far as the Middle Eastern and North Africa category, which was not added, which means that folks from that region are still counted as white Americans. And then the flip side to that is the Hispanic Latino category, where I am Latina, have two boxes. So I have to check ethnic background and a multiple of racial background. So tell us about where we are with that.
The way it works is that we basically have two questions right now in the census. One is the Hispanic ethnicity question. That's the question where all of us get asked, are you Hispanic or Latino or not? And then there's a separate question, the race question. Now, the options that you can check off on that race question are white, black, Asian, American Indian or Alaska Native, or Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander. And there's also a some other race box. So what's happening right now is that although Latinos may get to the first question, check off Hispanic and be okay with that, they're still required to fill out the race question. And they get to that and the Census Bureau research shows that a lot of people just don't know what to do. And a lot of them, about half or so, end up checking white. Another number almost as large end up checking off some other race, some check off black. But what the Census Bureau research over the last decade has shown us is that most Latinos, they don't want to have to be forced to check off white or black. They'd be comfortable with having a box on that race question that says Hispanic or Latino that they can go to. Same with people of Middle Eastern and North African descent. Arab American, Iranian American, other groups of Middle Eastern, North African origin basically petitioned the census over the last decade to put on a box for them. And so without having that box, again, you'll have another group of people, another sizable group of people who are going to feel like there are no good choices for them on the race question. And the bottom line problem there is that then our data are no good because people are just picking off, they're checking off the white box or something else in kind of a willy-nilly fashion that doesn't really reflect who they feel they are.
Right, and it doesn't really give the nuance to how people's identities are changing. I mean, I know I checked three race boxes on the census because I'm assuming that's as accurate as it's going to be. Another question is about the citizenship question. Let's talk a little bit about what that means.
This is really a really hot potato issue because the Department of Justice has gone to the Census Bureau recently and said, we'd like you to put a citizenship question on the census. There hasn't been a citizenship question on the full census since 1950. There's currently citizenship question on the smaller survey, the American Community Survey that the census runs, but nothing on the national scale of the census. And this is really problematic for several reasons. The first reason that it's problematic, and the biggest one, I think, is because if it comes to pass, it would have a chilling effect on response rates, right? The Census Bureau really needs to get everybody to respond to the census in order to get the accurate counts we need. But this is a question that is just a recipe, as my colleague on the committee, Arturo Vargas, said, it's a recipe for sabotage. It's going to make a lot of people feel, regardless of whether they're citizens or not, are going to make them feel like maybe they shouldn't, maybe their status isn't, if they're naturalized citizens, for example, maybe they shouldn't be checking off. And a lot of people will be scared that this information could be used against them. There's also some technical problems with it that just in general, the census tests its questions in advance really carefully over years to make sure the questions work well, people know how to answer them, the data are good. If we rush on a citizenship question at the last minute, we just don't know how good that's likely to work. And we also don't know, is it going to take up space from other things? Are we going to have to kick something else off the census in order to make room for a citizenship question? So there are a lot of technical problems too.
Isn't this an example of what we talked about earlier and as far as politics getting in the way of the count?
It certainly seems that way, right? That it's clear that we're in a moment where the administration wants to basically convey to America a narrower sense of who belongs here and who should be here. And we're doing that through changes to immigration policies. We're doing that basically through the president's pronouncements about the kinds of people who should be here, Norwegians and not Nigerians, mm-hmm. to paraphrase him. And so this would be just another kind of instrument for sending that message that there's some people who are not really part of American society today.
Thank you so much, Anne, for being here today.
Thank you.
Anne Morning is an associate professor of sociology at NYU and a member of the Census Bureau's National Advisory Committee on Racial, Ethnic, and Other Populations. Over the last few years, TV has been looking really different from when we were kids. From the 1980s to 2017, the number of characters of color with speaking roles has nearly quadrupled, up from about 8% in the 80s to hovering around 30% today. Shows like Black-ish and Fresh Off the Boat proved to TV networks that audiences, even white audiences, would watch shows centering on all Black or all Asian families.
It heralded a kind of a milestone for television in the sense that it proved that those shows were shows that everybody, even people in the heartland of America, were willing to watch. But we've also seen ever since, you know, November of last year, a lot of conversation in television around whether or not diversity has gone too far.
That's Jeff Yang, journalist, host of the podcast They Call Us Bruce, and father to a TV star. His son, Hudson Yang, plays the main character on ABC's Fresh Off the Boat. And Jeff recently wrote a piece about the latest phenomenon in television, the revivals and reboots of many 80s and 90s TV shows. And those make us feel nostalgic, but they also come at a cost, which is pulling back on diversity and sometimes in favor of all white casts of the past. I asked Jeff to lay out what shows we're talking about here.
We're really talking about just about everything you may have grown up with if, like myself, you're a kid of the 80s and 90s. Magnum P.I., Cagney and Lacey, Murphy Brown, Roseanne, The Greatest American Hero, which is kind of a deep cut for some.
Wow, that is a deep cut. They dug in the crates for that one.
They really did. And I mean, I'm kind of looking forward to that one for a lot of reasons. But, you know, we've already seen this phenomenon gaining traction with, you know, X-Files and Dynasty and, you know, other shows that are on the air currently. And what we're seeing is that the networks are just doubling down, essentially, on the phenomenon of everything old is new again.
Well, first of all, you very astutely give us the distinction and between what's a revival and what's a reboot. So for our audience members, can you give them a sense of what the difference is?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one thing to take old bottles and put new wine into them, so to speak. I mean, a reboot is taking a storyline or a situation and recasting it and kind of bringing it into the contemporary era. But what has been really interesting is that there have been more of these revivals proposed. And maybe the best example of that is Roseanne, right, which is coming back in a matter of weeks. Roseanne features the entire original cast of the original series. It's sort of follows on as if nothing has happened. The clock has just sort of been set forward a little bit. So it was like a kind of collect them all sort of thing. And they managed to pull this cast together to continue on, much as they did with Will and Grace, which is on the air right now.
So there is one thing that we're not talking about yet. You mentioned this in a piece you wrote about this revival of the revivals and the reboots. You say, like the original, Murphy 2.0, that is Murphy Brown, won't be all that brown. So, you know, for those of our listeners who don't remember the show, Murphy Brown was a show about a career woman, Candace Bergen, who I think for many young women of my generation sort of exemplified this, you know, early or, you know, third wave feminism, if you will. But here we are missing an element of racial diversity.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that is clear if you look backwards at that era, and again, it's an era I grew up in myself. I watched these shows and was devoted to a lot of them, is that if you're a person of color, if you're non-white, you really never saw yourself on screen, not even in many cases in the background or as an extra. These were shows that were set in some kind of parallel dimension where non-white people were carefully hidden behind lampposts. And certainly they weren't part of the main ensembles. And back in the 80s and 90s, I mean, you know, the tenor was that that was kind of okay. There were shows for, let's say, black people on the WB and the UPN. And then there were shows for everybody else, for, you know, the mainstream. And those shows were largely cast with white folk and white actors. And that's what we're seeing when you actually do these revivals, reach back and take the same casting tropes that existed back in an era before inclusion, before diversity really kind of became the buzzword. You're reviving that as well. And it feels like a lot of these, whether it's unconscious or not, I think that in many cases where Hollywood is concerned, Hollywood may not be overtly racist all the time, but it's certainly looking for money. And whenever they see a change in the weather or in the wind, they try to race down a path en masse to follow it. And the themes we're seeing in the world today are ones about the quote-unquote forgotten people of America, the white working class heartland, et cetera, even though those are people who have been happily watching the likes of Blackish and Fresh Off the Boat over the last several years, there's a perception that somehow those individuals aren't being served by diverse TV.
Now, I just want to ask you one last question about reboots. There's the reboot of One Day at a Time, which is now with the Latino family, and they're sort of dealing with issues of gender identity and sexuality. And do you see that as being potentially the future for a lot of these, instead of revivals, just rebooting them to be more culturally relevant?
I mean, you know, we've been rebooting stuff since Shakespeare and onwards, right? Since the days of you know, the ancient Greeks. People have taken old stories and retold them in interesting ways. And One Day at a Time, you mentioned, is a fascinating example of how you can do that. Take a story that is resilient, but change it to make it feel relevant today. And in the case of One Day at a Time, she's a woman of color who's also a military veteran and who has a daughter who is encountering sexual identity discovery and who is relating to the world through those lenses. We're seeing that more and more with reboots that are taking risks in that fashion. The Greatest American Hero was originally about kind of like average white guy finding this alien supersuit and becoming a superhero. But the reboot that is currently in development actually is going to star a South Asian woman named Mira. And as a result, it's not going to just challenge the idea of what greatest means, but even quote-unquote American and quote-unquote hero, right? So, you know, all these things are in the mix when you're reinventing the things against a reality of different genders, different races, different backgrounds, different heritages.
Sounds kind of like the national conversation. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jeff Yang, journalist and host of the podcast They Call Us Bruce. In this era of revivals and reboots, we asked you guys to reach back and think about shows from your younger days. What would you do to update those old favorites for 2018?
My name is Scott from Akron, Ohio. And one TV show from my childhood that I'd like to see revised if it were updated would be Happy Days. And perhaps rewriting with more offerings from the alternating perspectives of Marion, Joni, Arnold, Leather Tuscadero, and Ralph.
Different Strokes, addressing not only blended and non-traditional family, but also LGBTQ issues. Mariama, Glasgow Kirkland, Houston, Texas.
This is Daniel from Portland. I would love to see Captain Planet brought back, but in a way that actually highlights modern technological advances and some of the possibilities we could be exploring.
So how would you update a beloved show from your youth to make it more relevant for today? Put it in a tweet and let us know. We are at The Takeaway. Back on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega here. Now consider this for a moment.
I've never been asked what I am in my own imagination.
That's Morgan Jerkins. She's reading from her new book, This Will Be My Undoing.
What is a black woman to herself out from under the shadow of the white woman? For black women, whiteness and white womanhood linger over our heads, smothering our consciousness every day. But we are not the inverse of whiteness, or white womanhood for that matter. Still, our bodies find a way to come back to us distorted like images in funhouse mirrors. We know something is wrong with the distortions, but we cannot say what.
Morgan joined WNYC's producer of special projects, Rebecca Carroll, as part of our book club series, Reading the Reckoning.
Hey, Morgan.
Hi.
Let's get right into the book. There's this narrative of a certain black experience that is drawn to whiteness, mm-hmm. whether it's because of circumstances like myself, who was adopted into a white family mm-hmm. and raised in an all-white town, or for you, influenced by this kind of narcotic caste system. So, what exactly is the draw to whiteness? Beyond, I mean, and we could certainly just simplify it by saying, oh, ease, sanity, power, privilege. But when we're younger, I don't think we think in those terms.
No. When I was younger, I just wanted to be validated, to not ever have that sense of I'm not supposed to be here, to never have that sort of questioning that I have to fix myself in order for others to be comfortable with me. And I think even when I was a kid, that was what I sort of grew up with, even though I didn't have vocabulary of like respectability politics or colorism. As a child, I mean, from the first chapter, when I'm talking about cheerleading tryouts, I was 10 and I still knew, I was like, I'm not meant to be here. There's not a place for me.
But you were drawn to it.
Yeah, because they were everywhere and no one questioned their beauty and no one questioned just who they were as people. And I just thought that the way for me to get that relief, as crazy as that sounds, is to assimilate.
It's so interesting, though, too, because throughout the arc of my own writing career and career, you know, I've sort of reached this point where I almost feel like I need to divest entirely from whiteness mm-hmm. because I was so mm-hmm. entrenched and inundated and swallowed by mm-hmm. it. But you write about wanting to be swallowed by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I had low self-esteem, very low self-esteem. I did not really believe in my own beauty. I didn't really believe my beauty as a black girl. And because of that, I wanted to be absorbed. I just thought that because whiteness is so powerful, so all-encompassing, it's just swallow me right up because I don't want to be out there by myself.
Right. And the adjacency to it. I remember that so vividly.
Yeah.
It's like, I know how I'm going to play this.
Right.
Right. Because I see where the power is.
Right.
So I'm going to position myself adjacent to that power. We've done it our whole lives.
Right, because it's like, I don't want to fight. You know what I mean? And if I fight, you know, when you're a kid, it's like, I don't want to fight. I don't want to, you know, already stick out more than I am. So I'm going to try to be like you.
Right.
You know, even in when I was in sixth grade, the whole narcotic caste system that you said, I mean, there were white girls who were having these popular girl trials and they're all white people. And I wanted to be a part of it.
So you also, though, had friends of color.
Yeah.
And what were they thinking?
We never talked about it. You know, when I was trying out to be a cheerleader, I didn't talk to many of my friends of color about it because they didn't see reflections of themselves in that squad. They were, you know, doing other things. And I was obsessed with being on this team. Perhaps now that I'm thinking about it, as I'm talking to you, I was kind of ashamed because I felt like I shouldn't even want it because I don't even see myself on that squad. But I do want it. So I'm going to do whatever I have to be there.
And so why do you think you didn't see comfort or your reflection in your friends of color?
Man, I don't think it was enough. It was like when I looked at white girls, they could be validated in both white and spaces where they're people of color. Whereas for me, I was like, why can't I be validated with my black friends and also in these spaces with white people as well? Why do they get to have that fluidity and I don't?
And so did some of those friendships fall out with friends of color?
They didn't fall out in a sense when I was trying for the squad. Obviously, because I was so obsessed with getting on the squad, I didn't open up to them that way. So I remember like the communication was sort of it diminished. But I think when I talk about in the first chapter of my book, not all of my friends of color are black. So we also have to keep in mind that there are people of color who have to deal with anti-blackness as well. And when I got into an argument with a friend of mine who was Filipina, who we never were invited over her house, we never understood because she listened to rap music. She wore the New York fitted hats. I mean, she was in our group like that.
And she was fluid.
She was fluid.
Right, yeah.
You know, we accepted her as our own and whatever. And she literally said, like, you know, you know why you didn't get on that squad? Because monkeys like you don't get on that squad. And that was the moment where I was like, okay, so now it's even more compartmentalized. It's not just we're all not white. Now it's even further because now you just use anti-blackness against me. And the moment that we're arguing, I would never have used her ethnicity or race against her in an argument, even as a kid. It's like, why would I do that?
Right. I'm thinking, too, about the essay where you write about being a black gentrifier and trying to figure that out and navigate that and how you wrote you didn't know how to be in black spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious because your mother, who you're close with, mm-hmm. is black.
Mm-hmm.
Your origin, for mm-hmm. lack of a better word, mm-hmm. is black.
Mm-hmm.
So you always, at the end of the day, came home to a sense mm-hmm. of blackness.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it that you were unable to be in black spaces?
Well, my mother, and I'm very close to my mother, so I'm glad you picked that up from reading that. I think she was trying to make sure that I was socially mobile as possible. And so there are a few moments in the book where I talk about where it comes to my hair or the way that I was dressing in high school was like, I want you to look the part. You have to. You can't just be raggedy, as she says. So if that means I got to go and buy you these Argyle socks and not every black girl looks like that, then so be it, because I want them to see that you can, you know, walk the walk and, talk and, you know, all those things. But what I'll say about Harlem specifically is that it is the only place that I've been to where I was not conscious of white people. You know, even when I lived in New Jersey, yeah, when I'm in the kitchen with my aunties or when I'm at church, those are particularly black spaces. But if I go to a Macy's or whatever, I still have to be conscious of white people and their microaggressions. Whereas I know if I'm in Harlem, if for some morning I'm just tired and I don't want to take my scarf off, I know that when I go to the CVS, there's still going to be an employee there that says good morning to me. Nobody's going to look down at me and no one, and I'm acknowledged. And I think there are certain times where I can even go to the Upper West Side. I can go to Flatiron. And, you know, sometimes white women won't even look me in my face. You know, mm-hmm. they'll see me coming outside. They'll see me coming behind them the door and they'll just shut it. Mm-hmm. But in Harlem, it's the only time where I get that relief and it's widespread. I know that I'm going to be acknowledged. I know that somebody is going to address me while looking at me and saying like, hey, or I'll walk down the street and someone will give me a nod and say, I see you. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to be up in your business, but I know that you're there.
Mm-hmm. And the friend that you explored it with said, black people are everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy because, you know, I came from New Jersey and I knew that like part of the reason why Harlem seemed attractive to me because it seemed safer and I didn't really know the politics of, you know, gentrification like that. So I really read up on it. I was like, whoa, am I contributing to the problem? And then this man who used to work at the Schomburg, I don't know if he does now, but he took me to their nice garden there, you know, took me for smoothies and was like, listen, like, and he said it very kindly, but he basically told me, Your idea of blackness is so limited. Like, it's very limited. So what if I just told you there is no limit to that?
Right. And so that makes me think then, too, of the way in which you describe these black girls in middle school and high school who were mm-hmm. a certain kind mm-hmm. of black mm-hmm. girl, bold and brash mm-hmm. and that kind of that stereotype that is perpetuated. But these were not stereotypes. These were real girls.
Mm-hmm.
And that they did not adhere to your respectability politics. You didn't have the language for it then, mm-hmm. but you knew that that's what it was. But mm-hmm. of course we see and we celebrate girls and women who embody that kind of blackness today, particularly now in
right.
pop culture.
Right.
And so when you see those women, how do you feel? How has your impression or opinion of those girls and that sort of kind of blackness changed?
Well, I think it's admirable. I think, you know, even when I was in middle school and I saw these girls and they were so bold and they let people know that they were there. They didn't kowtow. In a way, I didn't have that then. Like I said, I wanted to be consumed and I wanted to get out of high school, middle school as early, you know, as quickly as possible so I can just do what I wanted to do. And so now that I feel like we're in this time where it's like unapologetic black girls, carefree black girls, I wish that I would have heard those phrases when I was in that age where I really needed it.
I think about that all the time. Black girl magic, honey,
yeah,
I could have used that.
Yeah, right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Would you read a little bit for us?
I have never been asked what I am in my own imagination. What is a black woman to herself out from under the shadow of the white woman? For black women, whiteness and white womanhood linger over our heads, smothering our consciousness every day. But we are not the inverse of whiteness, or white womanhood for that matter. Still, our bodies find a way to come back to us distorted like images in funhouse mirrors. We know something is wrong with the distortions, but we cannot say what. This is the magic that I believe Claudia talks about in The Bluest Eye. But if we are not the opposite of whiteness, then what are we? Maybe the truth is that we are invisible to ourselves. The truth is we are all clamoring for something ancient within our souls that is still virgin from white touch. We are nostalgic for something that we cannot claim, an artifact within ourselves that was not chained when our foremothers were transported across the Atlantic to the New World. The Portuguese call this saudade, feeling a loss or absence of something that we know will never return. We may never find it, but we must keep digging anyhow. It is an arduous battle to piece together our existence while we are trying to resist during our individual lives. I do believe in the Audre Lorde saying that you cannot dismantle the master's house with the master's tools, but we've been working in that house for centuries. We may know the tools better than the master, and we must all know the ways in which they operate in order to destroy the master's power over our lives. We must consider white womanhood, If we abandon that prematurely without studying its influence, then we will not know all the ways in which that power functions so that we can trap it before it traps us. But we must not dwell on it for too long. For as long as white women have been appropriating our bodies, we have been insulted and afflicted. And frankly, I am tired of being in such an abusive relationship that I never agreed to in the first place. There was never any honeymoon period. There is no need to consider those who take without giving, speak without listening, and use feminism as a way to unify without analyzing black women's differences and their complications.
Wow. So timely. And also so just really cuts right through to so many things that black women all share. Mm-hmm. But I was struck by that idea of who you are or what you are in your imagination. What are you in your imagination?
Whatever I want to be. And that is something I never allowed myself. I think when we talk about these ideas of black girl magic, unapologetic black girl, carefree black girl, self-care, care. I never cared about myself because I was too busy comparing myself to the white girl in front of me or the white girl that I'm going to soon come in contact with. And so when I think about what I'm going to do today, what I'm going to wear, what lipstick I'm going to put on, you know, even something as simple as like, oh, I couldn't wear yellow lipstick. Like that just seems like something I see white girls wear. No, I'm going to wear it. Why am I limiting myself? And is that my conditioning? And how do I keep unraveling that? So I think, you know, when I was, you know, the context for that essay, when I was thinking about Rachel Dolezal, where, you know, it was painful to watch people say, well, why can't she be a black girl? And then to see all these black girls saying she can't be us because she doesn't know us. And even though, and I agree with all that, but I said, okay, well then how do we know each other then? You know what I mean? How do we study who we are without whiteness creeping in and becoming the center all over again? And how do we have these conversations that aren't confined to the kitchen table, that aren't confined with just black women, because other people need to hear it?
That sort of makes me think about, you know, yes, we are in this moment of really embracing sort of unapologetic blackness and a kind of Cardi B out there kind of feel. Mm-hmm. But it also feels like whiteness can only take in a couple ways of being black, right? So
right.
It's Cardi B or it's Serena Williams.
Right.
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 But there is a spectrum
yeah.
of ways of being black. I don't
right.
mean more black or less black. I mean a ways of being individually black.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, yes, have that conversation. Mm-hmm. We also have to claim those identities. Where do you fall on that identity spectrum?
Man, it depends on the situation. Because if I'm really passionate about something, I can talk with a cadence that's not like this. If I'm doing interviews.
Don't ever talk with a cadence that isn't like that.
You know, like it just code switching, right? But then
right,
that's another form
that's
of
yeah.
survival that we do. And I think, you know, and it's something that I really want to write about as well and think about more deeply. Because I think for so long, even in black circles, we think of blackness as a measurement tool that someone else can say that person's less black because they like anime.
That's right.
That person's less black because they listen to Metallica. And it's like, isn't that a form of white supremacy, though, that I can't digest what you're doing? So what I need to do is measure it. Because that's the only way I'm going to be able to understand you. And I think that's the same thing with whiteness. It's like this huge divide between like, oh, are you an Angela Davis or are you going to be a Beyonce? And it's like, well, what about the women that oscillate between the two?
Or just are on a different
level. Or just on a different level.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I also wanted to say in my book, and I make it very clear at the end of the first chapter, like I am not the only story that's out there. There are many privileges that I admit to, and I have to put out there and say that these are the privileges that happened that, you know, informed my life, influenced my life, but they can't speak for everyone else. So you have to keep digging for these other stories.
And so why did you write this book?
I wrote this book first and foremost because I wish that I would have had this type of book. And I think about all the conversations that we have about black womanhood. And I was like, why? And I was, you know, at the time I was reading so many essay collections by white women and exposing their interiorities just unabashedly. And I was like, well, why can't I do that? And it was interesting because when I was writing the book proposal and I had to do something called comp titles, which you have comparison titles. And I was looking within the last 10 years and I was like, for black women specifically, and I was like, this is hard. And I said, okay, I'm not the end-all, be-all, but I'm just going to see what happens, and let me send it out. And thankfully, a publisher took it.
speaking of which, I mean, you tweeted this morning, like, in the past 5 months, like, all of, or however many months, the past month, five folks have gotten book deals. In the past year, the amount of essays and memoir and books by young Black folks is incredible. It's a really amazing time, I think, for Black for being a Black writer. But I think what has also affected that is social media. I mean, you're very active on Twitter and social media. How do you feel like – how do you use it?
Oh, I mean, I use it to tweet about the books I love. I use it to talk about, you know, irreverent things like men or food or, you know, be vulnerable with people, because New York is it could be a very isolating place. And there have been many moments where I'm just like, I just want to talk about something and make a thread. And I'm lucky to find people who gravitate towards it. But I mean, I also want to make it clear that if it were not for Twitter, I would not be where I am. I met my agent through Twitter. My agent is a woman of color. The acquiring editor for this book knew me through Twitter. Like that. Otherwise, I'd probably be on my fourth unpaid literary internship by now. I'm serious.
No, I believe you. I know. And I've watched you soar, and I can't wait see you soar even higher. The book is called This Will Be My Undoing, Morgan Jerkins. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was WNYC's Rebecca Carroll and author Morgan Jerkins in conversation as part of our book club series, Reading the Reckoning. That's our show. I'm Tanzina Vega, and I'll be with you for the rest of the week. You can tweet me at Tanzina Vega, or you can tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.